Okay, so we continue with lecture 21. Pretty difficult stuff. We're trying to extract from the Einstein equations information about gravity, even when we cannot solve the equations explicitly. So just on the basis of a few assumptions, we want to find out crucial things, such as information about horizons and the occurrence of singularities. This is conceptually quite important. The question is whether general relativity predicts its own downfall. Does it really predict that there must be singularities? Not just that there can be, but there must be singularities. So for that purpose, the plan is this. We study suitable notions of causality, horizons, and singularities. Today we'll study Cauchy horizons, and we'll start with singularity theorem. Remember, we assume that the space-time that we're considering is stably causal. So it's causal, it doesn't allow closed time-like curves in a stable fashion, meaning that even if you perturb the metric a little bit, you still don't have closed time-like curves. This means that inextendable paths have only two options. Remember, before we assumed that, there were three options for inextendable paths. either inextendable paths go to infinity, or they end in a singularity, or, and that's the third option, which we now exclude, is that the path just goes round and round and round. That would be a closed time-like curve. We are excluding that because we are assuming that the space-time is stably causal. Remember, an inextendable path, we defined that last time, is a path without an endpoint. An inextendable path is a path without an endpoint in the manifold. That could be, as I said, one of three cases. It has no endpoint because it just keeps on going to infinity. Or it has no endpoint because it goes in a circle. Or it has no endpoint because it runs into a singularity, where there is no point of the manifold. Okay, so we've reduced this to two possibilities now. Of course, eventually we want to nail down the singularity case. So let's continue to study inextendable curves on the way to singularity theorem. We will need for that purpose the concept of Cauchy horizon and the concept of global hyperbolicity. Now, remember we considered the set of points that we called J plus, the so-called causal future, which consists of all those events that can somehow be reached from a set S. So a set S is a set of events. It could also be just one event. And the causal future of that event, or the causal future of that set of events, is the set of all those events that can be reached from S, either by time-like or by light-like path. This is the set of all points that can be affected by what is going on S. Similarly important is the set of points that can only be reached from S. The set of events that are causally connected only to the events in S. So the corresponding definition is that if S is a subset of events in our space-time, and assume that it is an achronal set, which means that there's no time-like curve between any two events there. So think of it as a space-like hypersurface, as a set of space-like separated events. Then the definition says that the future domain of dependence of that set of events S is denoted by D plus for future. Future domain of dependence of S is the set of all those events in the space-time which are such that every past inextendable causal curve from P backwards to the past intersects S. Here's a picture for what this means. So let's say this line here corresponds to our set S. And we are asking, What is its future domain of dependence? Which events in the future depend only on what's going on S? Now, for example, an event that sits here will depend on what's going on over there. Okay, that can travel at 45 degrees over there. It will depend on what's over here, but it will also depend on stuff over there. That's not in the domain of dependence. An event that's here is in the domain of dependence of S, because what's happening over here at an event there can only depend or only depends on what happened on S, because the backwards light cone intersects completely only S, nothing else. It doesn't depend on what's happened outside of S. Or put it differently, if you know the initial conditions of your time evolution, if you know the initial conditions just on S, you should be able to calculate, to predict what happens in exactly the future domain of dependence, and only there. So for all those events, you can predict what's going to happen if you know the initial conditions here. But you cannot predict what happens over there, because that, in addition to depending on those initial conditions, will also depend on the initial conditions over there. Now, if there's, and the technical definition was that every event in the future domain of dependence is such that every one of its past-directed causal curves intersects S. So from here, for example, if I go on a causal curve backwards, I can't go any shallower than 45 degrees, so I'm going to hit the curve S, the set S, right? But consider that point here, Q, where this is a singularity. So this is a hole in the manifold. There is no point of the manifold. This point has been taken away. For example, because curvature became infinite, you can't have a point of the manifold with actually an infinite tensor field on it. Or, for example, just because we took it away. But in any case, there is a singularity. There are other kinds of singularities too, as we will see later. Then in that case, this event is not in the future domain of dependence of S, because not all past causal curves actually end up on S. There are curves, for example, this one, which hits the singularity. And it's not extendable beyond that. So it's not extendable because there's a lack of point, of a point in the manifold. So it cannot go all the way to S. So you see that this singularity is therefore casting a shadow, so to speak, on this future domain of dependence. If there weren't a singularity, then the future domain of dependence would go like this, of course. In all those pictures, we always draw, roughly speaking, time upwards and space to the right. And similarly, we can define a past domain of dependence, of course, which is defined, so D minus of S is the set of all those points for which all future inextendable causal curves cannot help but hit S. So for example, for this S here, that event would be in the past domain of dependence because all causal curves will hit S eventually. If you're over there, some causal curves hit S, but others don't. So that will not be the point in the past domain of dependence. So past domains of dependence always look triangular in shape, except if there is a singularity that casts a shadow. Then the next definition is, of course, that the full domain of dependence of S is the union of the future domain of dependence and the past domain of dependence. So the full domain of dependence is the set of all those events which are such that what happens at them is completely determined by what happens on S. Now let us look at this picture again. Then this boundary here will be important. These are the latest events that only depend on what is going on S. Everything that's a little bit outside there is not only depending on S. A crucial definition is that the future Cauchy horizon of S denoted h plus of s, is by definition the boundary of the closure of the future domain of dependence. So we close this set, and then we subtract the interior. Okay. So that is the future Cauchy horizon. That's the future Cauchy horizon over there. And then, of course, we can define also a past Cauchy horizon in the same way. That's the past domain of dependence, and then again we subtract the interior. And then the full Cauchy horizon of a set of events S is the union of the future Cauchy horizon and the past Cauchy horizon. Is the question? Yes. Yeah, I couldn't see you. Sorry.
As opposed to just saying it's the boundary of this set?
Right, it turns out to be the boundary.
Okay, so that is as equivalent?
Yes, yes. It's a proposition coming up in a moment. See, there we go.
Yeah. Yes.
Very good. Okay, so that's the proposition. We want to prove it. It's not exactly, not completely trivial, but you can show it. Now, a key definition is that a closed achronal set S is called a Cauchy surface, not Cauchy horizon, but a Cauchy surface, if its full Cauchy horizon vanishes. We want Cauchy surfaces. Let me tell you why. Okay? So what it means is that the full Cauchy horizon vanishes. It means that the boundary of the full domain of dependence is empty. There is no boundary. It means that the full domain of dependence towards the future and the past is the entire manifold. What it means is that if we know what's going on F, then we can predict everything everywhere for the future, and we can post-dict everything everywhere in the past. There's no boundary to the region where we can predict or post-dict. So Cauchy surfaces are great if they exist. It means that on a Cauchy surface, you can completely predict forward and post-dict past. There are slightly differing definitions of what we had on the past few slides in the literature. These are the definitions following Wald. The other definitions are equivalent, but a little bit more tedious. A Cauchy surface is always achronal. We had a theorem earlier about achronal surfaces. And therefore, a Cauchy surface can always be viewed as an instant in time. And the term surface is motivated by this theorem, namely a Cauchy surface, let's call it sigma, is always a three-dimensional continuous submanifold of the manifold. This is true for space-time, so for 3 plus 1 dimensions. Here's a term that you've probably heard in colloquia and read about in papers, the term globally hyperbolic. If a space-time possesses a Cauchy surface, then it is called globally hyperbolic. Historically, this goes back to the fact that the equations of motion that we are considering in general relativity, and not only in general relativity, also in special relativity, are mathematically what is called hyperbolic. And what this is saying is that we are guaranteed the existence of a well-defined initial problem, initial value problem. The reason why these differential equations are called hyperbolic, I don't know whether you're aware of that, but if you write down your differential equations on flat space and Fourier transform them, then the derivative operators become multiplication operators. So if you have a bunch of derivatives in your equation of motion, then this turns into a polynomial in the momenta. And if you visualize the polynomial as a quadratic form, then you get either a parabola, a paraboloid, or you get a hyperboloid or an ellipsoid. And if you get an ellipsoid, then you call it a differential equation of hyperbolic character. Okay, so the definition is that if the spacetime possesses a Cauchy surface, so if there is a space-like hypersurface, let's say, so that you can predict all of the future and post-predict all of the past, then it is called globally hyperbolic. We will later need this definition because it will be one of the assumptions going into a singularity theorem, into a cosmological singularity theorem, which will give us a criterion for being able to conclude that space-time started out with a singularity. Even if space-time has no symmetry, so even if the Friedman-Robertson-Walker solutions cannot be used. One can prove a few things about globally hyperbolic space-time. First of all, there exists a global time function in this case, global time function that we may call f, so that every surface of constant f is a surface of constant time, and each such constant time surface is a Cauchy surface. And it turns out that globally hyperbolic spacetimes are also stable and therefore also strongly causal. So if you perturb them a little bit, then you still can't have any closed time-like curves. That's guaranteed if the spacetime is globally hyperbolic. You can imagine these things are not easy to prove. Remember, our plan is to study inextendable geodesics in order to detect singularities. In particular, in order to detect singularities even when we don't have solutions to the equations of motion. Just from properties of the Einstein equation, we want to be able to conclude that singularities are unavoidably forming. So how can we identify those geodesics which are inextendable because they end at singularities of the manifold, as opposed to geodesics that are inextendable because, I mean, inextendable means they have no endpoint. As opposed to the possibility that they just run to infinity and therefore don't have an endpoint. Or as opposed to cases where, in a trivial fashion, the geodesic doesn't have an endpoint, but it is simply because we took it away. So there's a perfectly nice space-time, like Minkowski space, and we take out a point. Well, then, in a sense, this is a singularity. There will be geodesics that run into that singularity there and cannot be extended. But it's a trivial kind. Let's remove that possibility. And we do that by considering spacetimes that are themselves inextendable. But here the word inextendable is used in a different sense. Namely, we say that a spacetime is inextendable if it is not isometric to a proper subset of another spacetime that's bigger. So for example, if we just take Minkowski space, take a point out of it, then this resulting Minkowski space with a hole in it is simply a proper subset of another spacetime, namely full Minkowski space. And so we can always extend spacetime there. If, on the other hand, we have a real singularity, for example, curvature blows up at the point, then that point is missing in the manifold, and we can't see this manifold now as being part of a bigger manifold in which everything is fine. Cannot. These are the real singularities that we are looking out for. So we will restrict attention to spacetimes which are inextendable. If they are extendable, we consider them to be extended. So holes like arbitrarily taking out a point have been fixed. Then we say that a geodesic which is inextendable in this case, so it doesn't have an endpoint in the manifold, but it possesses only a finite range of its affine parameter, such a geodesic is called incomplete. Okay, so imagine a situation now. That's a geodesic which doesn't have an endpoint in the manifold, but its internal parameter, like the proper time, for example, or the affine parameter, in case it's light-like, its internal parameter reaches only finite value. So in this case, the geodesic cannot run out to infinity. This is the case where we will have a singularity. The geodesic runs into an obstruction. It can no longer go on, even though the space-time has been maximally extended, trivial holes have been filled in, and even though the parameter of the geodesic only reaches a finite value there. So the definition is that a space-time possesses a so-called singularity if it possesses an incomplete geodesic. And then we can try to detect such singularities either by using time-like geodesics or space-like geodesics or light-like geodesics. Now, when we're going along incomplete geodesics, geodesics that at a finite value of the parameter hit an obstruction, can no longer be extended, and there is no endpoint in the manifold there. So when we go along an incomplete geodesic towards a singularity, then one of three things can happen. It's very subtle. These are the three different kinds of singularity that general relativity allows. And there are quite different kinds of singularity. The first singularity that can happen is that a scalar constructed from the curvature tensor diverges. So for example, we could consider the Ricci scalar. Maybe when we travel along that geodesic, that incomplete geodesic, maybe the Ricci scalar simply blows up, goes to infinity, and where it goes to infinity, there is a lack of point in the manifold. There cannot be a point where it's actually infinite. Or it could be that some other scalar that is built out of some polynomial of the Riemann curvature tensor blows up. Maybe this stays finite, but another scalar made out of the Riemann curvature tensor blows up. Again, that's a regular curvature singularity. Notice that we are dealing here with scalars. Scalars are coordinate system independent. So whether or not these things blow up does not depend on the coordinate system chosen. Remember that in the early days of general relativity, it was thought that at the horizon of a black hole, we have a singularity. Because in Schwarzschild coordinates, the Schwarzschild metric seems to blow up. But of course, the metric as a matrix is very much coordinate system dependent, or at least basis dependent. But at that time, they always chose the basis in the tangent spaces that came along with the coordinate. So yes, components of the metric tensor were blowing up, but then it was found that there are coordinate systems in which the very same metric, the Schwarzschild metric, doesn't have singular components, so it's fine. And there really is no singularity at the horizon. And things like the Ricci scalar and any scalar you can build really out of the curvature tensor will all be regular across the horizon of a black hole. It's only at the singularity of the black hole where stuff blows up. Okay, so the point I want to make is that you can look at scalar quantities made out of the curvature tensor and check whether they blow up. And that will tell you why there is a singularity. It's a kind of curvature singularity. But there could be something very subtle going on. There could be a singularity, and yet none of those guys blows up. It could be that the Ricci scalar stays regular. It could be that any scalar you can build with any polynomial of the Riemann curvature tensor also stays finite, and still you have a singularity. How could that happen? Well, it could happen because whenever you form scalars out of a tensor, you have to contract indices, which means you have to sum up terms. And it could be that the terms individually blow up, but their sum doesn't. So it could be that some curvature tensor components blow up and others don't. And yet others do, but with the opposite sign, so that overall, when you contract the indices, you end up with something finite. So the scalars are finite, but the scalars arise as a sum of terms which individually blow up. And if you're really unlucky, that may happen independently of what coordinate system you choose, independently of what basis you choose in your tangent spaces. So how do we ever detect that then? Well, we can do that by choosing a tetrad coordinate system. Sorry, any coordinate system you like, but we choose a tetrad basis. We choose an orthogonal basis in which the metric is always, you know, the matrix of Minkowski space. And then we look at so we have a fixed basis now, and we look at the tangent space, and we look at the Riemann curvature tensor. Now its components no longer depend on the coordinate system. Okay? Now its components are scalars, are just functions. And now it has a meaning if these things blow up or not. So we check whether perhaps components of these coefficient functions of the Riemann curvature tensor blow up as you approach that singularity. So sometimes it happens that the scalar curvature terms don't blow up, but some components do in a basis independent, in a coordinate system independent way. In this case, we say that we have a parallel propagated curvature singularity. Third possibility is none of the above. It could be that you find that there is an incomplete geodesic. It cannot be extended. And you check why that is. And you find all the curvature scalars stay finite. And even the components in a co-moving frame of the curvature tensor all stay finite. And yet there still is a singularity. And these are then so-called non-curvature singularities. An example arises when you take, let's say, a piece of paper, and you roll it up like an ice cream cone, like this. Okay? So in this case, you don't actually have any curvature happening. See, this is not curved. This is still not curved. There is still no Riemann curvature when you just bend a piece of paper like that. Parallel transport is still trivial. It's still trivial if you do this, okay? And if you now roll it into an ice cream cone, like that, still the case that there's no curvature anywhere, except here at that point, it's not well defined. See, at this point, the manifold, I mean, it's not differentiable, it's just not a differentiable manifold at this point. Everywhere else, it is, but not at that point. That point is a singularity. Even though everywhere outside, it's just flat. So it's a non-curvature singularity. That can also happen. And geodesics can get stuck at those points as well. OK, so let's get back to the fundamental problem we wanted to address. In concrete solutions, such as the Schwarzschild solution or the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker Lemaitre cosmology, curvature singularities are obvious. We can see. Yep. Stuff blows up, curvature scalar, other terms in the curvature blow up. So we do know that there are singularities. But these spacetimes are highly symmetric. And the big question is, do more realistic perturbed spacetimes also exhibit singularities? That is highly non-trivial. Remember the example of spherically infalling matter? If it's completely spherically informing, you can convince yourself that that eventually has to end up in a singularity, where you have infinite mass density all in a point, and probably curvature singularity, and so on. But then if this spherical infalling mass is actually starting out in a non-symmetric way, and perhaps a bit rotating, and so on, then it could well be that this stuff misses each other, just like the figure skater who pulls in her arms. And then it's conceivable that the singularity might be avoided. Does this happen or not? This is what we need the singularity theorems for. So ultimately, the idea is to use singularity theorems to show that the prediction of the existence of singularities is a robust prediction. And then it's a task for quantum gravity to explain why there shouldn't be singularities if we believe that there really aren't any singularities in nature. Once we know what sufficient conditions are for singularities to form, we can ask, how can quantum theory avoid those conditions? So here's a general strategy for singularity theorems. It's a bit involved, so I give you a scheme for it, and then we go through the details of that. There will be points from A to E, and then we'll discuss them individually. So first of all, to build a singularity theorem, we focus attention on singularities that can be identified by incomplete geodesics, which are time-like, or perhaps light-like, that is not. In principle, we could also work with geodesics that are space-like. But usually, people don't bother with those. They might be there. It might be singularities that perhaps can only be detected this way. But we are going to try to detect singularities using time-like or null geodesics. The reason is that those singularities are bound to be important. Because what it means is, remember, a singularity means the geodesic is incomplete. At a finite value of its parameter, it reaches a non-extendable location. Which means that if you travel along those time-like geodesics, and you could, in principle, travel those geodesics because it's time-like, then at a finite time on your wristwatch, for you, the universe comes to an end. Right? Because your geodesic ends. And there is no further space you could go into, space or time to go into. So these are the important geodesics for practical purposes in the sense of you traveling. Or, so that would be the case of a black hole. You travel for a while, and then at the final time of your wristwatch, the end of the universe for you. So it's not just that you're being crushed. It's literally the end of the universe for you. There is no time beyond that for you. But you can also look at it backwards in time towards the cosmological singularity. There it means that if you follow your wristwatch back in time for 13.8 billion years, then you also hit not the end of the universe, but the beginning of the universe. That's where your timeline starts. And there was no space or time before that. OK, so we will look at incomplete, inextendable, time-like geodesics. And we'll be looking for reasons, for conditions, in which those time-like geodesics might be inextendable towards the future or towards the past. Towards the future, that's the case of black holes. Towards the past, mostly the case of black holes. Towards the past, that's mostly the case of cosmology. OK, so that was point A. Point A was we are considering inextendable time-like or light-like geodesics. Point B in the search for singularity theorem. Basic idea is that singularities can be in the way of a geodesic. So the presence of a singularity, which is an obstruction in the path, the presence of the singularity interferes with the key property of geodesics, which is that they are paths of extremal length. A geodesic can no longer be a path of extremal length if there's something in the way, if there's a singularity in the way. Point C on the path to developing a singularity theorem. Remember, extremizing curve length leads us to the geodesic equation. This is how geodesics can be defined. And the geodesic equation is a differential equation. So locally, geodesics are paths of extremal length. Space-like geodesics are curves of shortest proper distance. But are you aware that the geodesics that we are going to consider, the time-like geodesics, are actually not paths of shortest proper time? They are paths of longest proper time. Right? So it's a generalization of the least action principle, but really in general relativity. The time-like geodesics are the paths of maximum eigentime travel. You have any intuition for why that might be? Well, imagine out there in the universe, there's an event where a billiard ball is being released and it floats towards another event where it is being caught. Okay, so the billiard ball just goes from here to there. At a particular place, at a particular time, it starts, it's being launched, and then a little later, a little different place, it is received. And it takes a certain amount of eigentime for the billiard ball to travel from here to there. Never mind our lab time, just the eigentime of the billiard ball. Now, why is that the maximum amount of eigentime? Imagine the billiard ball were to travel a different path, not a geodesic, just a different path, so that it starts at the same time at the same place and arrives at the same time at the same place where before it just went a straight path. But now, the new path is one where the billiard ball goes on a huge trip. It goes like this and there, and goes in loopings, and then eventually, just in time, it arrives at the right place. Okay, so overall, we have two billiard balls. One goes whoop, and the other one goes a huge path, but with tremendous speed, because it has to arrive eventually at the same place, at the same reception place at the same time, right? But this other billiard ball that was traveling this huge path was very fast. And you know that when something's traveling very fast, its internal clock passes slower, right? So the direct line is actually the path of maximum eigentime. And the same carries forward to the case of gravity as well, of curvature as well. Okay, so the time-like geodesics are curves of maximum proper time, proper eigentime. Okay, so then the point D will be, we prove that even in a generic space-time, there always exist curves of maximum length between two events, like an event Q and event P, no matter if there might be curvature and stuff, but still there's always some curve of maximum length between two events. We need some assumptions for this to be true. And a key assumption that is sufficient for that, and that's why we bothered going through that definition, the definition for that assumption is that space-time is globally hyperbolic. If space-time is globally hyperbolic, you can conclude that between any two events, there exists a curve of maximum length between them. And then finally, E and F. F is the conclusion. Finally, we then prove, so everything else before was pretty innocent perhaps, but this is where the meat is. We prove that in the circumstances that one chooses to consider, for example, cosmology or infalling matter that describes a collapsing star or something like that. So in point E, we prove that in the circumstances that we choose to consider, these extremal length curves, so those geodesics, cannot be geodesics which have an eigentime larger than a certain finite amount. So their internal parameter can only go to a finite value, either into the past or into the future. So we show that that in these circumstances, there are geodesics which have only finite value. They run only to a finite value of the parameter. Their wristwatch will reach a finite end value. So we show that there are incomplete geodesics, and incomplete geodesics end where there is a singularity, by definition. So this could be the wristwatch time being finite could be because the observer runs into a black hole, or it could be because the universe has a finite age. And so either the wristwatch time is bounded in the past, or it's bounded in the future. This, of course, will be the difficult thing to show, that geodesics can only run to a finite value of their parameter. But once we have that, then we can conclude that they're incomplete geodesics, and we have singularities. So here is now a concrete cosmological singularity theorem. Let us assume that space-time is globally hyperbolic. Remember, this guarantees that there are always going to be paths of extremal proper time. And secondly, we will need to assume that the energy momentum tensor of whatever stuff there is in the universe obeys the so-called strong energy condition. We haven't had that before. We had the weak energy condition, and we had the dominant energy condition, and I will review them in a moment. But this is a new one. That's the strong energy condition. And the strong energy condition says that for all time-like vector fields psi, this particular scalar ought to be larger or equal to zero. I'll get to the interpretation of what that means in a moment. For example, the weak energy condition translates into the statement that the energy density has to be positive everywhere. The strong and the dominant energy condition translates into the statement that energy and momentum only flow into the future, especially only inside the light cone. What does the strong energy condition mean? Not so easy to explain, but I'll tell you in a moment. And we have to make an assumption about the existence of a C2 space-like, so twice continuously differentiable space-like Cauchy surface of the space-time, on which the trace of the extrinsic curvature k is bounded from above by some negative constant c. So here's the trace of the extrinsic curvature, and we assume that it is bounded from above by some negative constant c for all points of this Cauchy surface. All right, well, we'll go a little bit more into detail about those things, but let me give you already the gist of it. So the extrinsic curvature means the following. It means how it's the curvature between space and time. The intrinsic curvature is the regular space-space curvature. So if you take a space-like hypersurface, then it itself is a Riemannian manifold. And it has a curvature tensor. And that is the intrinsic curvature. The extrinsic curvature is the way in which this space-like hypersurface is embedded in the space-time. So it describes the curvature between space and time. But what is curvature between space and time? Curvature between space and time is expansion. Expansion of space-time is space-time curvature. It's the curvature between space and time component. So what this says is that there is a bound on the expansion, that it is at least as big as that. It's because the intrinsic curvature is the negative of that expansion, as we will see. OK, so we have to have that there is some expansion going on for the purpose of this, for the purpose of this singularity theorem. But what does this thing say, the strong energy condition? Well, it's not obvious. I'll show you in a moment why, how this comes about. But this condition essentially, well, not just essentially, but it exactly, requires that your space-time be not inflationary. So it requires that the space-time is not actually exploding in an accelerated way. The W parameter, if we were to work with the Friedman-Robertson-Walker Lemaître spacetime, the W parameter would have to be larger than minus one-third. Now, below minus one-third, we have inflation. We have accelerated expansion. On an FRW spacetime, this condition is only obeyed if the W is larger than minus one-third. That's a crucial condition, it turns out, because if the spacetime is accelerating too much, I mean, if it's expanding too much, if it's actually accelerating, then if we look towards the past, we ask, was there really a singularity? There may not have been one. So if you want to prove the existence of a singularity in the past, you want to prove the existence of a Big Bang, this can screw it up. Remember the solution of a universe that is dominated by a cosmological constant. If the universe is only driven by a cosmological constant, if there were no matter or no significant amount of matter, just a cosmological constant, then the expansion rate would be, the expansion would be exponential, right? That's the Sitter space, exponential. But an exponential scale factor doesn't have a singularity. Yes, it blows up the universe very dramatically, but towards the past, it's just exponential decay, but it never goes to zero, right? So too much of an expansion, if it's accelerated, actually doesn't give you a singularity at the beginning. So that's excluded here. So you need expansion, all right, but you don't want it to be accelerated in order to be able to conclude that there was a singularity in the past. Okay, so the singularity theorem says that if space-time is globally hyperbolic, if the acceleration, if the expansion of the universe is not accelerated, or technically if this so-called strong energy condition is obeyed, and if the extrinsic curvature obeys that bound, which means yes, it has to expand now, which means it has to shrink towards the past everywhere in order for the theorem to kick in, well then the singularity theorem concludes that no past-directed time-like curve from our space-like hypersurface sigma, where we had this condition hold, this one, no past-directed time-like curve can have a proper length larger than 3 over c, where c is that constant which bounded the expansion rate. Which is to say our clocks, our wristwatch, are not going to show any time larger than 3 over c because they cannot have been ticking for longer than 3 over c because there was a singularity in the past. All past-directed time-like geodesics are incomplete. The conclusion of the theorem is that all past time-like directed geodesics are incomplete. Not just one clock, but everything. You can imagine having a little wristwatch attached to it. And this wristwatch cannot ever show more than 13.8 billion years. So we can then conclude that there's a cosmological singularity in the past. Okay, so let's go through the various ingredients there. Remember, the extrinsic curvature of a space-like hypersurface describes how much curvature there is between a space-like hypersurface and the time dimension. Intuitively, it is the rate of expansion of space-time. More precisely, it's negative. You can also think of it this way. In classical mechanics, if you want to predict how a system will behave, you need to know its amplitude now and its time derivative. You need, so to speak, the position and the momentum of it, and then you can calculate how it's going to evolve. If you want to apply that approach to general relativity, you can do that. There is a Hamiltonian way of writing general relativity. And then in that case, what is the position and what is the momentum? Basically, the position, the status quo, the situation of space-time now is given by the intrinsic curvature that the space-time has now. It's the intrinsic curvature. And then what's the momentum that space-time has? That's the extrinsic curvature that it has, the rate with which it is expanding. The rate with which it is changing its intrinsic curvature. Okay, so you can have basically a canonically conjugate pair of intrinsic and extrinsic curvature, intrinsic being like the position, extrinsic being like the momentum. So the bound on the extrinsic curvature here says that space-time has to have a finite minimum expansion rate, or looking towards the past, a finite minimum shrinkage rate everywhere on space-time at a particular point. So now, what was the strong energy condition again? Let's compare it briefly. The weak energy condition we had already, the weak energy condition is very plausible. It says this, and by choosing for all time like vectors v, and in particular, it means that the energy density, see, if you choose for the vector v, you can choose a vector with components 1, 0, 0, 0. Then you see that this is simply t 0, 0 larger than 0. So the energy density has to be larger or equal to 0, very plausible. The dominant energy condition is the weak energy condition, plus you also require that the vector k mu, is time-like or light-like, and the vector k mu is the contraction of the vector v with the energy momentum tensor. This means that energy and momentum, and this is what that is, this is the flow of energy and momentum. Remember, in the Killing vector field, these are really the conserved energy and momentum. The flow of energy and momentum has to be time-like or light-like, which means that the flow of energy and momentum has to be on or inside the light cone. Also very plausible. Now we are dealing with a strong energy condition for the purpose of the singularity theorem. So remember, the strong energy condition is obeyed by matter if that matter has an energy momentum tensor obeying that condition for all time-like vector fields psi. This, in effect, excludes matter that is causing accelerated expansion, as we said earlier. Not clear at the moment how to see that, but I'll show you very soon. So that's the intuition. Is it plausible? It's sort of plausible in the sense that the strong energy condition is known to be obeyed by known forms of matter, electromagnetism, electrons, quarks, that sort of stuff. But it's not obeyed by dark energy, because dark energy drives W towards a value smaller than minus a third. It drives the universe to expand in an accelerated fashion. And dark energy, when put in there, doesn't obey that condition. What's the relationship of the strong energy condition to the weak and to the dominant energy condition? It turns out there is no causal relationship. It's not stronger or weaker than any of the previous conditions. The dominant energy condition is a stronger condition than the weak one, but this one cannot be ordered among the others. Now, what are they concretely again? For known forms of matter, the energy momentum tensor can be diagonalized. So we have the energy density here, and then we have the pressure, or if they if the pressure depends on the direction, then we call them principal pressures when we diagonalize them. So for known forms of matter, the energy momentum tensor can be put in this form. And then the three energy conditions, the weak energy condition, the dominant and the strong energy condition, mean the following for those components rho and p. The weak energy condition means that the energy density is larger than zero. And the dominant energy condition means that the energy density is larger than the pressures. And the strong energy condition means this particular condition, which does not really make any, is not really anything plausible. However, if we play with it a little bit by saying, okay, we consider for a moment the Friedmann, Robertson, Roberts, Lemaître solutions, then we have an equation of state parameter W. So we can express the pressure in terms of the energy density, namely the pressure is W times the energy density. So we replace this P with W times the energy density. If we do that, we find that the conditions of the strong energy condition mean that W has to be larger than minus one third, which is a condition that we've seen earlier, and it means that space-time is not accelerating. Might be expanding, but not in an accelerated fashion. Or looking back in the past, it is shrinking, but not in an accelerated way. Sorry, not in a decelerated way, right? That's important. See, if it's shrinking the space-time towards the past, but the shrinking is decelerated, then it can be that it just never actually shrinks to zero. And that's how a singularity can be avoided. So dark energy can avoid its cosmological singularity in the past. We have to exclude it. So then remember point E in the strategy to prove a singularity, cosmological singularity theorem was really the part that had the meat in it, where we wanted to show that there are incomplete geodesics where the eigentime reaches only a finite end time, where the wristwatch, you know, reaches a certain point in time, like 5 minutes past 5 o'clock, and that's the end of the universe for you. How do we identify that the geodesics are really incomplete, that they come to an end? Well, we identify that by studying a particular observable that's called the expansion theta. Before we go to the technical things, let me explain what that is intuitively speaking. So imagine a scene like in this movie Gravity. So you have your spacesuit on and you're floating in free space. Around you there are galaxies and stars and so on, and they pull at you. And the universe is expanding too. So, but you're not alone. Instead, you have a circle of friends with you. Okay, they're all suited up in their spacesuits. And like a ballerina, you're in the middle, and your circle of friends is a circle of friends all around you. Okay, so you have like 50 friends all around you, and you're in the middle of that. And you all together float through space. Now, because space-time is curved, and is not curved everywhere the same way, because curvature is changing, because space is expanding, you and your circle of friends will feel that. You're traveling on a geodesic, all right? Okay. But you and your circle are not going to be undisturbed by what is going on in the universe, by the changing curvature. And several things can happen. In particular, your circle of friends may turn into an ellipse of friends. Okay, in such a way that the ellipse has the same area as the circle. Or that area could increase. You could find that your friends will drift away from you. In fact, that's what's going to happen because space-time is expanding. Space-time is expanding, so eventually your friends will go further and further away. If you look towards the past, your friends will get closer and closer. Your circle of friends will get closer and closer. At the beginning of the universe, you become one with your friends. Right? Another thing that might happen is that your circle of friends might just rotate. Okay, so it's not shrinking, not expanding, just not deforming the size, the shape of the circle. It's just rotating, right? Okay, so there are these three things going on. Your circle of friends might just change shape in an area-preserving way, so it turns into an ellipse. Another thing that can happen is that your circle of friends just rotates. Another thing that can happen is that your circle of friends might just go smaller or larger, as the space-time underneath you is basically expanding or shrinking. The expansion parameter is measuring how the size of your circle of friends is changing over time. And we will check for a singularity in this. To conclude, that your geodesic and the geodesics of your friends are going to intersect. Okay, and so that's where the singularity will be. All right. So how do we get at this expansion theta? For that purpose, let us consider a so-called congruence of time-like geodesics. What might that be? Consider a space-like hypersurface, so a moment in time, and you consider all of the universe at a moment in time. A space-like hypersurface sigma. And then you consider a smooth family of time-like geodesics where each geodesic goes through the space-like hypersurface at exactly one point. So basically, it's not just you and the circle of friends, it's just infinitely many friends all over the place, and they are all just traveling free-falling through space-time. And let's say that the geodesics are parameterized by the time on wristwatches, so by the proper time. Then the tangent vector field for all those geodesics is simply d by d tau, where tau is the time of the wristwatch. So we choose the tangent vectors to be normalized such they all have length minus one. In that case, it's the wristwatch time that is shown when we plot the geodesic parameter. Now, here's a picture of you with your friends, no longer a circle, it's just friends everywhere, all over the place. So let's say you're in the middle there, that's you, and here are your friends all traveling on geodesics. And let's say time is upwards and space is horizontally, it's plotted horizontally. So this black line is a line of constant wristwatch time for you and your friends, and that's another line of constant wristwatch time. Okay, so all constant time lines. And then as you go from here to there, you have to somehow label your friends. Let's just give them names, which are just numbers. And so you just number them in a continuous fashion. You have infinitely, uncountably many friends. And All right, so these are lines of constant S. You are having one particular value of S. This friend has another particular value of S, okay? So what we want to know is how two neighboring geodesics drift away from each other or approach each other, just freely floating. So we consider now a family of neighboring geodesics. So if you hold S fixed, you're holding an astronaut fixed. And then as you run through tau, you get a path. You get the path of that astronaut. If you plug in another S, you get the path of yet another astronaut, right? So S is parameterizing this way. Tau is parameterizing that way. So the key question is, this vector eta is pointing from you to your neighbor, right? D by ds. That's the direction vector from you to your neighbor. How does that direction vector from you to your neighboring friend, how does that direction vector change as you travel, right? So let's say your friend is over there, you point to your friend, indicated by the vector eta. Now you float through space, and your friend might be floating somehow, you know, rotating around you or going further away or whatever. And so you keep tracking where your friend is. This is what the vector eta does. So we want to know how eta changes as you keep floating. But first of all, we have that the two derivatives with respect to S and derivatives with respect to tau commute. You can think of it as, you know, being orthogonal to each other, just two partial derivatives, or you can work it out explicitly. So let's call this d by ds vector the vector field eta. Oh, actually, we did that already. And the vector field in the direction, in the time-like direction, we called xi. Therefore, this equation, the commutativity of those two derivatives, is really that equation here. Now we can spell out what that is. Remember that covariant derivatives are linear in the coefficient functions here and there. So we pull out these coefficient functions. Then let's change the notation from the nabla for the covariant derivative to the semicolon. So we get this equation. And so that equation here, you know, this equation holds for all of the basis vectors in the tangent space. So we can drop those e here. So we get that for the coefficient functions. And that's now the key equation for calculating how your friends move relatively to you. So here we have xi mu eta nu semicolon nu equal to that expression here. And the key point here to notice is that it depends on the eta vector, the vector that points to your friend, times that thing which you can view as a matrix. Let's just consider it to be a matrix now. Let's call it the matrix B nu alpha. So this matrix B nu alpha has this upper index, that lower index there. And it's obtained by differentiating the time-like vector field, the direction field in which you're traveling, covariantly differentiating it in the mu direction. So what we see here is that remember, the left-hand side is what? It is the covariant derivative of eta along psi. So it's the derivative, so it's the rate of change of the vector that points to your friend as you travel along your geodesic path. Okay? So this thing gives you the rate of change, the direction in which the vector changes that points to your friend as you float along your geodesic path, where psi is the tangent along your path. So that is over here. And this is given by the vector that points to your friend multiplied by this B matrix. Okay, so along the geodesic psi that you're traveling, the deviation vector eta that points to your friend changes its direction and possibly its length according to that matrix here. And you just take that direction vector to your friend and then contract it with that matrix, and you learn in what direction the eta is changing. So everything about what can happen with your circle of friends is encoded in that matrix B. The circle becoming an ellipse, the circle growing or shrinking, or perhaps rotating. Let's see how that's encoded in that matrix B. So the matrix B is in general neither symmetric nor antisymmetric. We know very little about it really, a priori. But we can always decompose it into a part that is anti-symmetric and a part that is symmetric. Let's just do this for a start. So any matrix can be decomposed in this way into the sum of a matrix that's anti-symmetric plus a matrix that is symmetric. And further, it will turn out that it's useful to decompose the symmetric part of that matrix into a part that is traceless and a part that has a trace. That's a unique decomposition. And it will turn out that the omega matrix, the antisymmetric part, will describe your circle of friends rotating, and the traceless part of the symmetric component will describe how your circle of friends turns into an ellipse without changing volume or area. And the remainder, the trace part, describes how your circle of friends, while it's floating with you, will increase or shrink in size. So first of all, we have that the antisymmetric part is simply this, of course, right? So you just write down this plus the B with the commuted indices with a minus. So that thing is antisymmetric, 1/2, that's the antisymmetric component. That's easy to obtain. But how do we obtain those, the trace-free and the remainder part of the symmetric component? In preparation, let us define a projector. The projector onto the orthogonal complement to the time-like tangent vector along which you're traveling. It turns out that the projector onto the space that's orthogonal to your trip, so the projector onto what is space for you, right? Psi is time for you. It's your tangent in the time direction. So everything that's orthogonal to that is what is space for you. The projector onto that is h mu nu. And h mu nu is g mu nu plus psi mu psi nu. Let's see. Is that really the projector onto what is space for you? Here's this supposed projector. And here we take some arbitrary vector. And then we ask whether that vector that you obtain by contracting an arbitrary vector with this projector onto what is space for you, whether that is really always orthogonal to psi. This is the claim, right? The claim is that this thing projects any arbitrary vector into something that's orthogonal to psi. Well, let's calculate that. So we have psi, and we have the h mu nu, we have w. So that's the inner product of, see, the h mu nu is this. And so we get one term from the g mu nu. That's just the inner product between psi and w. And then we get that term in here. So we get xi mu, xi nu, xi mu, xi mu. And then we get xi w in a product. Now the xi is minus 1, right? That's your time direction. It's a time-like vector, length minus 1. So that's a minus 1. Therefore, you have this minus that is equal to 0. So indeed, this thing is the projector onto what is space for you. Then we can finally define the expansion. The expansion of your, you know, circle of friends. The expansion theta is defined as the magnitude of the spatial part of B. So we take the B matrix, the thing that tells you how the eta vector that points towards your friend is changing direction and length and so on, and we project it, we apply the projector to it. We contract it with the projector onto the spatial part. And this turns out to be simply the trace of B. Remember the claim was, just to update you again, claim was that the decomposition is this. B describes how your the vector eta to your friend is changing. And it's decomposed in the omega. I claim that's going to be the rotation of your circle. The sigma is going to describe the deformation of your circle into an ellipse. And the t mu nu, which is the part that does, that is symmetric but has a trace, whereas this is symmetric without having a trace, this part will have the expansion in it. The expansion being proportional to the to theta. Okay, so the theta is by definition the contraction of B with the projector onto the space-like part. And that is the trace of B. There's a little calculation that shows that. Let's skip over that. And so therefore, we have that the symmetric part, which is traceless. So remember, B is decomposed into three components. And the middle component was the sigma, which is the part that is symmetric but has no trace. So that part is the symmetric part of B. We simply symmetrize, okay? And then we subtract the trace. We subtract the trace multiplied with the projector on the space-like part. We need the factor of 1/3 because the trace, if you build the, if you calculate the trace of the whole thing, the trace has to be 0, right? Now, what is the trace in particular of that h mu nu? And there's a little calculation that shows that it's 3. So we have to divide by 1/3 in order to make sure that this is the trace of this matches up to minus sign the trace of that, so that the whole thing is traceless. And therefore, the third part in the decomposition of that B matrix is the part that is symmetric and has a trace. That's this one. It's just, you know, opposite sign of that. So we have now decomposed our matrix B into those components, the antisymmetric part, which will be responsible for rotation, the symmetric part that has no trace, just deforming shape, and the symmetric part that has a trace. That's the symmetric part with a trace. That's the symmetric part without a trace. So here's the interpretation of the three terms. As predicted, omega mu nu is antisymmetric. If you remember, antisymmetric matrices can be viewed as generating rotations, infinitesimal rotations. So the omega mu nu actually generates Lorentz transformations for eta. So actually, your vector eta that points to your nearest neighbor friend will undergo a Lorentz transformation as you travel along if there is an omega mu nu present. However, the etas are the vector that points towards your neighbor is, by assumption, by construction, is orthogonal to your time direction. So therefore, the omega mu nu actually generates only a spatial rotation. So it's not actually generating a boost, it's just generating a rotation. So this is a term that is generating a rotation of your circular friends around you. Nothing else. No expansion of the circle, no making it an ellipse, just rotating them. This tensor omega mu nu is called the twist tensor. And one can prove, and it's not trivial, that if one chooses the congruence of geodesics to be orthogonal to the space-like hypersurface that we are considering, then actually that omega vanishes. Now let's look at the next term, the symmetric term that has no trace. So your eta vector pointing to your friend has to be contracted with sigma, right? It's a component of B, in order to tell you how that direction vector changes as you float along. And we can always choose a basis in space such that the sigma matrix, because it's symmetric, will be diagonalized. And then what we see is that it will be diagonal matrix, and the sigma mu nu will change, therefore, the relative lengths of the ether vectors on which it is acting. So an ether vector in this direction, like in the x direction, might be shortened by the action of sigma. If you have a friend in that direction, let's say the y direction, then maybe that distance will be lengthened. If your friend over there might be unchanged, for example. So if you have a circle of friends around you or a sphere of friends around you, then that sphere will become an ellipsoid. However, since the trace of sigma is vanishing, we have that the determinant of the exponentiation of that matrix that generates that transformation. Now, we're doing just like a translation or rotation. Here we have, again, an infinitesimal transformation. And we exponentiate it to get a finite transformation. If we calculate the determinant of that, we are calculating the change in the volume of a parallelogram made up of a vector that points to a friend in the x direction, a vector that points to a friend in the y direction, a vector that points to a friend in the z direction. We find that the determinant, which calculates the change of that volume, is equal to 1, just because sigma is traceless, right? E to the power of something traceless gives you a determinant that stays 1. If you don't see why that is, easy. Just exponentiate, write out the exponential as 1 plus blah, 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 higher powers in sigma, right? Okay, and then you see that you get only a contribution from the 1 and not from the other terms of the sigma traceless. So the volume spanned by the basis vector stays the same under the action of sigma. So the sigma tensor is called the shear tensor. And by the way, these calculations, these tensors are important not just for the purpose of singularity theorems. Imagine you want to actually calculate the collapse of a star. You need exactly those things, right? You have geodesics of infalling matter, and you want to know how does the infalling matter behave as it rushes towards the center. And there can be all those things going on. You can have a twist, a rotation, you can have a shear that we just calculated, or you can have also compression of the geodesics, and all of those things, of course, in general happen at the same time. So finally, let us look at the expansion tensor. So the twist and the shear tensors are both traceless and therefore volume preserving, right? The twist tensor that rotated your circle of friends was traceless simply by virtue of being antisymmetric. And then the shear tensor was the traceless part of the symmetric component. And then all of the trace of B was stuffed into that expansion tensor, which was 1/3 times the scalar function theta times that projection onto the space-like component. So therefore, this thing is the only thing that generates spatial expansion or contraction of nearby geodesics or of your circle of friends. So what we will need to show then in the next and last lecture is that there are circumstances in which geodesics have a finite range, either to the past or to the future, particularly to the past, let's say. So we want to show that this expansion theta here actually reaches a value like zero at a finite time in the past. So where you become one with your friend, which would mean that the universe has compressed to the extent that everything is at infinite density. And then geodesics can no longer be extended. Okay, so that will be our task then for the next lecture. We will be able to conclude that the Big Bang singularity is a fact if we believe in classical general relativity and the strong energy condition is fulfilled, which means no inflation at the very beginning of the universe. And the tools that we will develop for that purpose have to do with calculating using the Einstein equation what the dynamics of that theta is. So what does the Einstein equation say about the dynamics of theta? So that's useful for concluding about Big Bang singularity, but also if you want to study anything in astrophysics, because there you always have some sort of flow of clouds of gases or collapsing stars and so on. Then you always deal with those tensors and their dynamics given by the Ray-Chowdhury equation, which is what we do next time. Okay? That's the question.
Did you have a purely shear singularity where your circle just sort of squashes and pinches off?
Yes, we will get to that. That you can actually have a situation where you can have a singularity where the universe is sort of compressed to infinite density in one direction, but not in other directions. So you can do that. Yeah. So you can have a compression that is offset by an expansion, so that overall you don't have a volume change. It's weird, but yes, can happen. Okay. Thanks.